Good morning. My name is Sean Lucan, and I have a little bit of different background and expertise than either Aaron or Kelly. So I'm a family doctor in the Bronx. I work in a federally qualified healthcare center, so urban, low-income, minority, underserved. And I would say that essentially all of my patients are overweight or obese and suffer from a variety of diet-related chronic diseases. And so that's been motivating for my research, so I focus mostly on nutrition and the food environment. I have no disclosures. I don't have any ties to the food industry and no financial conflicts of interest to report. Actually, I don't really have much in the way of any financial support to speak of either. So if anyone in the audience has some research money that's burning a hole in your pocket or some grant ideas, I'd love to talk to you after the session. But this project and really all the work I've done has benefited from student research assistants. So a lot of volunteer work and support from modest research stipends from their school. So I've been fortunate to work with some great students, and I'm presenting really this work on their behalf. So just to kind of take a step back and a little broader view of food environments and food...
Huh?
I could. Oh, can people not hear me? Is that better? I'm sorry. So to take a little step back and a little broader view of food environments, is this echoing? It's not there. Food exposures in general. I wanted to just put this graphic up. It's a little dated now. It's from 2010, but I think the data still applies. So it looks at publications related to focus of, in the food environment. And what it shows is that predominantly most of the research is looking at food stores and restaurants. There's a little bit of focus on schools, homes and work sites, and some other areas. But the food environment is a lot broader than just food stores and restaurants. And so, for instance, you know, in an urban setting, it includes street vendors, and I presented on that at APHA in the past and just recently published some papers there. It includes farmers markets, which I'm hoping will be accepted soon at the journal Appetite. And it includes other stores, right? So other non-intuitive retail, which I'm not presenting at APHA, but am presenting at another conference next week. And the point there is that foods are available everywhere. So pharmacies, dollar stores, hair salons, clothing outlets, there's all sorts of non-intuitive places that carry calories in all shapes and forms, and it's a constant exposure. And so these are sources of food in the environment, but then the other aspect of exposure is the advertising. Right, and so some of our earlier speakers talked about this, and so in an urban setting, you get marketed to pretty much everywhere you go walking down the street. So on the sides of buildings, on the sides of bus shelters, on the sides of stores, and even in the identifying information of what the store is, up in the sky, down on the ground. Here's one on a bench waiting area, and so this is really kind of pervasive in the outdoor setting. And there have been, prior studies that looked at this. So in 2009, there was a study looking at four cities, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Austin, and New York. And what it basically showed was that obesity-promoting ads, no surprise, seemed to appear more in low-income or low socioeconomic status and minority areas. And those same authors published another paper that same year on another aspect of their work and showed that not only were they in kind of these low-income and minority areas, but they were targeted to children, or they were around child-serving institutions like schools, daycare centers, libraries, rec centers, that kind of thing. And then, subsequently to that, Lenny Lesser, who was supposed to be our moderator today but couldn't make it, did some work showing that not only in Los Angeles, which has been a part of all of these studies and is a part of all the studies I wanted to talk about, so of interest to Kelly, also looked at census tracts in Louisiana, and including tracts around where we are today, and showed that food and beverage ads, the more there were per census tract, the greater the likelihood of the population would be overweight or obese. And then others have looked at advertising more generally, not focused on food, but just in terms of all the advertising that's out there, and showed that harmful advertising, so including food, but also looking at things like violence or demeaning depictions of women or that kind of thing, are also occurring more often in minority communities. So that certainly gives us a good sense of, kind of what the landscape looks like, and it definitely does a good job of scratching the surface. But what happens when you go beneath the surface, or quite literally underground? So some of you who have, you know, come from metropolitan areas that have subway systems, this may look familiar. This is from the New York subway, and there are, you know, food ads everywhere. So pretty much as soon as you, you know, head underground, you are bombarded with, you know, ads of all shapes and sizes, many of which are directed at food and unhealthy foods. And the only research that I identified on this really looked, in subway stations that is, looked specifically at alcohol, and it looked in the Boston subway system. And no surprise, you know, kind of similar findings to those looking at ads above ground, it seemed to suggest that alcohol ads were more prevalent in higher poverty areas and seemed to be around stations that, you know, around schools and areas that would expose children. So with the work that I wanted to do here, I wanted to say, let's look beyond the bottle and look at advertising more broadly and see what's happening in New York, or specifically in the Bronx. So we wanted to assess all the print ads in all the subway stations of the Bronx and look at that within a neighborhood context. And so this is one of the research assistants, Mamadou, who's in one of the Bronx subway stations assessing one of the ads. And I sent Mamadou and his colleagues out into the Bronx. So here's a map. This is the Bronx. It's one of the it's the subway map. So here's the Bronx. This is Manhattan down here. And there's seven subway lines in the Bronx with 68 stations. So I sent students onto all of the lines. They stopped in all of the stations and they assessed all the ads that were there. So from entrance to exit and then on both sides of the platform, looking at the ad size and then the content of the ads. So where they were, how big they were, and what they were selling. And then we compared that to data on surrounding areas from the U.S. Census and from the City Health Department, and we got data on ridership at the various stations from the City Transit Authority. And this is what we found. So across all the 68 subway stations, there were about 1,600 print ads total. Stations had as many as over 100 ads in a single station, if you counted distinct ads. But oftentimes the same ad was plastered over and over and over again, so if you counted duplicates, some stations had over 200 ads. We identified 146 different brands or organizations that were making advertisements, 11 of which are just over 7% we classified as unhealthy food or beverage. So those are things like candy, ice cream, sugary beverages, snack chips, fast food, and alcohol. And what we found, as you might expect, is that total ad exposure, so the number of ads times the size of each ad, directly correlated with ridership, right? So that makes sense. So marketers would tend to put their dollars where they're going to get the most bang for the buck and advertise, you know, where they think they're going to have the most influence. But interestingly, unhealthy food and drink ad exposure was inversely correlated with ridership. So what that suggests is it's not going to the widest possible audience. And either these food companies don't know what they're doing, which Kelly and Aaron's work would not suggest is the case, or there's some targeted marketing going on. So what we found was that, you know, the unhealthy food and beverage ads disproportionately featured or were directed at children. So here's an example of a Ben & Jerry's ad with like a graham cracker cow and little animated figurines playing with blobs of sugary, you know, icy treats. So that was one ad in one station. The unhealthy food and beverage ads were disproportionately in languages other than English. So here's a beer ad in Spanish. And they were in neighborhoods with lower high school graduation rates. So here's one as an example. So it's an ad for Target where they're offering you fresh groceries from Target. So Target coming to the rescue to provide fresh groceries like refined, processed, prepackaged pepperoni pizza. So doing the community a real service in the grocery provision. And then we had some other findings, too, just to give you a sense of orientation for those of you not familiar with New York City. So this is the Bronx up here. This is the island of Manhattan, which most people just think about as New York City. Here's Queens, Brooklyn, and Staten Island, so the five different boroughs. And essentially what this shows, so the Bronx is up here, and I think it kind of looks a little bit like a heart, and I often refer to it as the heart of darkness, because no matter what health statistic or sociodemographic factor you put up there, it always is the darkest or the worst. So this just happens to be poverty. It's old data, but it would still hold today. It wouldn't matter if you put sugary sweetened beverage consumption or fruit and vegetable intake or rates of diabetes or heart disease or hypertension or, you know, any of those diet-related disease outcomes. Everything is happening here. And so if this is the heart of darkness, I often say this right here is the left ventricle. That's where all the bad stuff is happening on these western side of the borough. So, you know, cartography being an imprecise science that it is, this is a more realistic projection. This is the actual subway map, or, you know, just kind of this schematic from the city or the Metropolitan Transit Authority. So if you can imagine that this rectangle is actually the same as the, you know, so you have to kind of twist your orientation and elongate a little bit. But what I wanted to show here is that all the unhealthy food and beverage advertising, so that's these symbols here, is occurring in this dark area, right? So the areas of the greatest poverty, the area of the greatest minority communities, the areas with the most or the least healthy dietary indices and the worst diet-related chronic disease. So everything, all the unhealthy food and beverage advertising is happening in these dark areas. And you can see these lines are spared, right? I mean, or relatively spared. So up in these areas where there's not such an issue. And what we found was, I mean, you know, so not technically statistically significant, you know, some arbitrary alpha of 0.05, but, you know, at least borderline and suggestive that, you know, there were more prevalent neighborhoods with higher poverty, higher sugar sweetened beverage consumption, and higher mean blood pressure and cholesterol levels. And I think, yeah, so I didn't make a slide. I thought we had much less time. I didn't make a slide with strengths and limitations. I mean, a strength of this work is certainly that, you know, it's kind of a comprehensive view of all the ads and all the stations of an entire metropolitan borough and one of, you know, in the busiest city of the world. You know, limitations are is that it's cross-sectional. So ads, you know, what we found in this one-time slice might not be representative of what, you know, is there today or tomorrow. Ads are generally up for 30 days, or when you buy an ad space, that's how long it lasts. So, you know, it could be different. I don't suspect it would be, but, you know, arguably it could be different. And the other thing is we don't know who saw the ads or how much of the exposure each individual took in, right, because we looked at every ad in the entire station, you know, and it's, you know, most people are not going to be on both sides of the platform and, you know, looking at everything from the entrance to the exit. But it's certainly suggestive in any case that there's some shenanigans going on. And so the conclusion is that unhealthy food and beverage ads may be targeted in neighborhoods with socio-demographic challenges and possibly diet and diet-related health challenges. And most ads are geared towards youth in high immigrant and high Hispanic or high Spanish-speaking areas. So that's pretty much it. This is just a slide of the people I'd like to thank, all the different students that were involved, and my institution and Lehman College, some collaborators there helped me with the maps and doing some of the GIS work for this. And that's my contact information there, and I'm happy to talk. It's a good question. I was hoping no one would ask that because I realized on the way over that. No, because we looked at it a couple ways. We used some parametric and non-parametric tests, so that we used Spearman correlations. We also did some logistic regression, and I can't remember exactly what those p-values referred to, but we looked at it a couple different ways. But one of the ways was by quintile, and looking at different levels within the different neighborhoods and just doing a correlation. That is true. Although most of the data that we have available is only, we don't have that level of granularity or high resolution. So obviously, yeah, and you know, and I'm not trying to game the system with the p-value, right? Like I want the numbers to speak legitimate. I mean, you know, it's a good point. Yeah. I mean, obviously, if we could, you know, and the sad thing is that the health. Is anyone here from the New York City Department of Health today? A little bit. Okay. I won't speak badly about them. No. I mean, I think the DOHMH in New York is, you know, very progressive and has done amazing work. Sometimes the data that they have available is not the data that they have is not so available to outside researchers, which is a little frustrating. So some of this data, like on the nutrition-related outcomes, they do actually have at a level of finer granularity than they release to the public. So, you know, I've been, you know, kind of communicating about that, but it's a, you know, it's a hurdle to overcome. There was a question over here? Yeah. So we don't know anything about the demographics of the ridership. So the ridership data just comes from literally turnstile clicks. So the department collects, the City Transit Authority knows how many turnstiles, how many times people go through the turnstile. One of the things I will say, though, is a big drive, so the biggest station by far is Yankee Stadium. And Yankee Stadium happens to be in, like, one of the worst neighborhoods in terms of all the health indices that you can measure. So that's a big driver reducing the influence of our p-values because, like, there's a place where people aren't necessarily targeting marketing to lower-income individuals. They're trying to get, you know, they're getting ads to, like, you know, sports fans and other people, right? So that dilutes our p-values, and we're trying to decide how to deal with that in the analysis, like whether to subtract that or not, or do a sensitivity with it included and with it not. But we don't know anything about the ridership. We can just make guesses about, you know, what's at the destination and who's there and who lived there and that kind of thing. It's a good question, though. Any others? We'll do one more and then we'll do a group. Yeah, okay. Go ahead. Yeah. So that was another question I was hoping I wouldn't get. So the legislation on this, like, really only, and it's all in legalese, and it's this the document that I was finally able to procure, you know, looked like it was written in, like, the 1940s. It's been Xeroxed 100 times. You can barely even read it, and it's, like, all off register. But it explicitly bans patently obscene or offensive sexual acts or excretory activities. Right, and then also, and then you can't do anything that's, like, explicitly legal or libelous, and it's mainly about you know, decency and defamation, right? But beyond that, you can pretty much put up whatever you want. And in terms of how to, you know, write policy or change the law or restrict what goes up, you know, I don't, you know, I'm not a legal scholar, and I think, you know, people more involved in the policymaking aspects of this would have a better answer. But I think, you know, if there were any way, you know, if not limiting the exposure to unhealthy food advertising, then it's saying, like, for every, you know, ad that you put up, for every unhealthy ad that goes up, there has to be a space reserved for, like, a healthy food ad, right? So for every ad that demeans women, there should be an ad promoting women or, you know, promoting education or talking about the advancement of women. For every ad for McDonald's, there needs to be an ad for, like, the local Bronx farmers market or something like that, you know, to kind of even it out. But, you know, like I said, I don't know how the devil would be in the details in operationalizing that strategy. I don't even know if it's legally possible or how that would work. But, you know, I think allowing for a more even playing field where there's, you know, a more equal exposure. I mean, as we saw before, you know, unhealthy versus healthy food advertising, I mean, way disproportionately favors unhealthy food. So if we could make it more of a, you know, if you put this here, you have to have this here to counterbalance, maybe that'd be one solution. But I don't have a good answer. And maybe we could talk about that in the discussion.